Welcome back, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Got a fine co-host with me today. His name is James Santel. You can find his show, Amicus, a law review, on Saturday mornings across the network from 9 to 11. We're going to get to the Supreme Court big decision from last week. Thanks, Jim, for being in the chair on Friday to handle that puppy.
We knew it was coming, right?
Yes.
And I knew you were monitoring it, too. I was getting wonderful notes from you about what is this all about, right?
As
we're
trying to
digest hundreds of pages all of a sudden of material.
I can be camping and consuming massive amounts of Supreme Court decisions at the same time. I wanted to answer a quick question that came in from our friend Bob in Madison. Hey, Bob, thank you for listening. He texted in on the from WMDX. Again, if you have questions or comments, you can join us via phone or text at 855-752-4842. Again, that's 855-75-CIVIC. Bob, on the Wisconsin biennial budget passed today by the Joint Finance Committee, going to a full vote before the legislature tomorrow, Wednesday, asked this: the Wisconsin compromise budget bill sounds too good to be true. What's the catch? How did we get here? What's going on? And I think the lion's share of objection coming from Dems that I have seen on the Twitter, or what used to be known as the Twitter, et cetera, has been around public school education, that general school aides weren't increased, and we still have per pupil funding that basically lags inflation. So that has been a point of contention for a long time. And when we look at special education, again, State Senator LaTanya Johnson, joining us for the first segment of the day, pointed out that they have been able to increase the reimbursement rate for kids that are special needs or SPED, special education. If you're in the education field here in Wisconsin, they had been at 35%. Those are the reimbursement percentages. Mind you, our voucher schools are at a reimbursement rate, I believe, of 90%. So why are the public schools getting, for lack of a better term, you know, the heart of the pointy end of the stick when it comes to special education? Dems had been aiming at a 60% reimbursement rate. They negotiated up to 42% for the first year of the budget, 45% for the second year of the budget. That is a significant win. Again, that's a 10%, you know, a 10-point increase. They're still 15 short of goal, but like, yeah, that's what happens when you have a Republican-controlled legislature. So I think a lot of the angst is around that public school funding, but that has always been a point of contention. And frankly, if you zoom out and you look at the sorts of legislation that Republicans have been advocating for and frankly existentially advocating for since Ronald Reagan, their objective is the defunding of public education. So in any and every way that we can shore up those funds, especially for our kids that have the highest level of need, in other words, our special education students, that is a significant improvement. Not enough for some, but again, if you happen to be in a royal blue legislative district in this state and you get to just vote no because you'll never have to face constituents that really wanted the compromise, that's an easy no. It's those that represent the communities at greatest risk, those in leadership that are making these hard compromises and taking these hard votes.
And you know, one of the other things that the senator hinted at, we didn't have a chance to go into it in great detail, was the future, right? And you asked a question about this as well. When you do these kinds of things, you send a message to those people, the naysayers, yes, but also the people who understand exactly the civics that we're talking about here today. It's also about the future. Here we have a situation where, again, not everybody happy with this resolution, lots of things you would have preferred to have gotten. But again, we've got to get up, there'll be another budget cycle coming up all too soon. And And maybe it begins to send the message that these pie-in-the-sky aspirations on both left and right simply will not stand. And maybe instead of doing this 48 hours before where we've got to have this all done, maybe we come to, in the wake of the listening sessions, come to some resolutions that are maybe closer to the middle, that great, wonderful middle where government probably should be. We do it in a way that acknowledges that this is government. This is the way it works. And it sends that message about the next time around as well.
And again, I have deep, basically reverential respect for Democrats that have to take these difficult votes. And they do so knowing that, frankly, arguing about harm reduction or harm avoidance is not a politically salient or easy path, that incremental improvements are not always the easiest political sell. But again, it really interesting time. Keep your eyes on what the state legislature does tomorrow. Again, once approved by the state legislature, the governor has 10 days. But keep in mind, keep your eye on the big brutal bill in our U.S. Congress, because we need our budget before the U.S. Congress adopts the budget reconciliation bill, and it is signed by the president in order to maximally preserve Medicaid funding in this state. I just wanted to give us the chance and give our listeners a chance to weigh in on, to talk a bit about the birthright citizenship decision from Friday. And folks, there are looking to be some big decisions still coming down the pike. There's the 1849 abortion law opinion. That's coming from our state Supreme Court. Again, we're going to have the House and the U.S. Congress vote on the budget reconciliation bill, because it's not the same as what they adopted back in May. So lots of things happening tomorrow. Keep your eyes on the news. I had so many reactions to the birthright citizenship case, which actually wasn't the birthright citizenship case that many thought it was. And the first one was, this was a case, and the majority clearly leaned into this quote-unquote technical interpretation or question that had been posed, and that is, can a district court issue a nationwide or universal injunction that materially impacts the rights of parties not before the court? And the majority in this decision that came down on Friday looked back to the way things used to be.
History once again. There it is. History and tradition. We've heard that before, haven't we, Maggie?
In the early times, and looking at bills of peace and all kinds of stuff, which we don't need to get into because it's hyper-technical, and to say, listen, district courts have a limited scope. And the idea that nationwide injunctions can reach the rights of non-parties when there may be other vehicles to do so is really interesting. There are problems with this, of course. That is, basically what they were saying is, go seek class actions. And there were a number of class actions about birthright citizenship and other matters immediately filed on Friday, because frankly, people expected this from this court. Hoped differently, but expected and had to plan for this eventuality. But to me, the much broader context here, Jim, is the fact that this court, the majority of this court, seems to a large degree to be both incapable of, unwilling to, and utterly either ignorant or willfully blind to the real harms that are being acted upon people who do not have resources and access. That is primarily what I see here. And so folks don't need to know what class actions are or nationwide injunctions. What the court did on Friday was say, you have to be able to go find a lawyer and potentially pay a lawyer in order to protect your rights. And I think that is overarchingly challenging for us as a democracy, in this moment, in this particular moment. Maybe 10 years ago, I wouldn't be so concerned about it. But in this moment, I think it's deeply concerning.
Absolutely. And you've got to be able to find that lawyer. You've got to be able to find the courthouse, which, again, the lawyers can do for you. Got to be able to articulate actually your particular harm. And then you've got to be a part of litigation that goes on. And that will happen now, as many people have said, in the wake of this multiple times across America. And, you know, it's so disappointing. I had the same reaction as you did, Maggie, as I'm reading through this and hearing about it, of course, on headlines. And we're on your show on Friday, quite literally, with the ink still wet on the order. And I'm thinking aloud about the oral argument. And it sure seemed to me as if Amy Coney Barrett was getting at something, which is, again, as we talked about, even the budget, right? Right down the middle, right? She seemed to be articulating this view that maybe what the court needs to do, as difficult as this is linguistically and operationally, needs to articulate a rule. As you just said, there are these large mammoth issues out there having to do with things like constitutional rights that apply to every single person. And it seemed as if Amy Coney Barrett was saying, as to those, we can perhaps identify some categories, maybe describe them definitionally. Other things may not be in that large category. And so we define a rule that lower courts said, again, they will interpret it differently. We'll have to have more appeals on all that. This is not an easy question, right? And so sometimes this notion, and again, it's written by Amy Coney Barrett. It strikes me as the kind of thing Alito would write, which is this hard line, bright line test and this approach to litigation and to jurisprudence that permits of no gray areas, strikes me that this is one of those areas where the Supreme Court would have, again, with great criticism, I'm sure, heaped upon it, identify some considerations, as they sometimes do in voting rights cases, civil rights cases, that lower courts should address in deciding whether or not the particular order that I am entering should extend beyond the Eastern District of Wisconsin, should extend beyond these particular plaintiffs. How far should it go? And then you appeal that, right? But give us some latitude to make all that, right?
The court doesn't do that. They've seemed substantially disinclined to do that in any of these cases. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that many of these cases, and listen, Donald Trump has accessed the Supreme Court's emergency docket or shadow docket 19 times.
Since January 20th, right?
Correct. Outstripping the totals of basically every other presidency and doing so in the first four and a half months of his presidency, 6 months now of his presidency. This is the problem. Whatever you may think about immigration and its enforcement, immigration and the way that we treat people who may be here illegally is the canary in the coal mine for individual rights. And if you have a Supreme Court that is, one, making access to the courts to vindicate individual rights more expensive and more difficult, while they are constraining the powers of the courts to respond to overreach or outright lawlessness by a president and his or her administration, what you have then is the court very much leaning into itself as the weakest branch. Mm-hmm. And that works only when Congress is able to step up and check executive power, which brings me all the way back to the idea that this court has again and again, specifically in the gerrymandering cases, not acted to ensure that Congress remains truly representative of us, the people. And that is leading to this gross imbalance of powers. We're going to dive a little bit deeper on that. What do we do about this? What do we do next? What does it look like? And are Democrats always playing catch up? Mm-hmm. We discuss this next. Jim Santel and I, your host, Maggie Dawn, right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join us, 855-752-4842. Text lines are open. Little problem with the phone line, so text in your thoughts and comments. We'll be back after these brief messages.